Barack Obama inherits a whole bunch of fights in court and in Congress that he might not have picked himself, but that does not mean he will always want to surrender when it comes to presidential power. And Barack Obama has the potential, because of a number of circumstances, and we could talk about that in Q&A, to be among the most powerful presidents in our history.
Good morning. Today is about as upbeat as it gets for the next couple of weeks. On Monday, Asaf McAdam, who teaches a course on suicide terrorism at West Point, will be here. Then on Friday, Lauren Waldman, who was counsel to Mahar Arar. He was the Canadian citizen who our CIA picked up at Kennedy Airport and sent off to be rendered in Syria. He'll be here. Actually, Friday afternoon of next week, there will be an interesting program that we are co-hosting with the president of the university. It'll be in the Rotunda, and it's Her Majesty's Ambassador, Sir Nigel Sheinwald, will be talking sort of globally about international relations. Sir Nigel was the equivalent of the head of the National Security Council during the Blair administration. Blair appointed him ambassador to the United States at the end of his administration, and he will be here at 2:30 on Friday afternoon a week. As all of you know, there is very limited seating in the Rotunda. It can only accommodate 125 people. So if you're interested in hearing Her Majesty's Ambassador, get there early. And then on February 16th, another lively, happy topic, Greg Stanton will be here to talk about genocide. After that, everything will be upbeat for the rest of the year. Bart Gellman will sign copies of his book following the forum. So at the end of the forum, please remain in your places and give him the opportunity to leave the room. You know, we always tell our guests that the questions that they will encounter in the forum are well-informed and thoughtful and very civil. He said he doesn't care about civil. If somebody wants to take him on, he's willing to mix it up. So you don't have to be civil today. No points will be taken off. Finally, an introduction. Let me thank all of you for your financial support. Every single organization in the United States that depends on support from its friends, from the public, is hurting big time. And unfortunately, we are not exempt from those worries. We have had a little downtick, but not nearly as severe as many others have. We depend on your support. We cannot, you know, we get no funding from the state or the feds. And so we are very much dependent on what you all do for us. And we are grateful for those who've written checks. Now, please go home and just write another one. That's Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum and chair of the forum. Barton Gellman, America's most celebrated investigative reporter, is a two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. In 2002, he shared the prize with several of his colleagues at the Washington Post, where he's a special projects reporter, for their reporting on the war on terrorism. And then last year, he and his colleague Joe Becker shared the prize for their series of articles on Vice President Cheney, which Bart Gellman has now turned into his book, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Gellman twice before had been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's a graduate of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, a Rhodes Scholar who earned his master's degree at Oxford. Gellman's first book was Contending with Kennan, Towards a Philosophy of American Power. In addition to his two Pulitzers, Gellman has also received the George Polk Award, Harvard's Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Journalism, the Overseas Press Club Awards, and numerous others. Please welcome Bart Gellman.
Now that was over the top. I boarded a U.S. Air flight from New York last night, and being a trained observer, I observed that nobody boarded with me. And I was, it turned out, the only passenger, so naturally that raised a question or two. Had everyone else confused Charlottesville for Charlotte and decided not to risk a dip in the Hudson? Had the flight crew confused me for Warren Buffett? And would it be so wrong to go along with that? Could it be that Thomas Jefferson's descendants here at the Miller Center and at the University of Virginia really do like to pull out all the stops for a guest? I choose to believe the latter. And I thank you all for your kind hospitality. And if anyone is heading to New York tonight, I'm happy to share my plane. Not long before the election, Penguin Press released my book, Angler, which was Dick Cheney's official code name. And so I also have to pause to thank the Secret Service for providing me an evocative metaphor for his style of governance. A friend of mine told me that if Governor Palin had got the job, I should make my next book Antler. It is unusual to study a presidency through the lens of the number two. The Constitution gives the vice president two jobs, and one of them is only implicit. You break tie votes in the Senate, and you try to keep breathing in case the president should happen to stop. The vice president is understudy for a very big role, and usually, unless the star departs the stage, he doesn't get many lines. My contention is that we can't understand the last 8 years and what happened without understanding the remarkably broad influence of this vice president. He was a transformative figure. Dick Cheney changed history, and Angler tries to be a very concrete and I hope vivid narrative of exactly how he acquired and exercised power, telling stories that we didn't know before. After 8 years of saying very little in public, Cheney gave about twice as many exit interviews as the president did, inexplicably none of them to me. One word kept cropping up in these interviews when Cheney tried for the first time to describe his legacy. He and his office, he said, had been consequential. Now, that's a fascinating choice of adjective if you think about it. You could use it to describe Gandhi or Genghis Khan. Or Hurricane Katrina. It's value neutral. Cheney's talking about power. He's saying, I mattered, and he's right. Cheney will largely be remembered, I think, for good or ill, as the man who guided the United States toward the dark side, which, I remind you, was his own term for the direction he had in mind after September 11th. He invoked that image the very next weekend on Meet the Press, and he knew exactly what he was saying. Later, in the 2008 campaign, he strongly implied that Hillary Clinton was the one who started calling him Darth Vader. But in fact, Cheney was the first to call himself Darth Vader. On CNN, an interview with John King, he once dressed his black Labrador, Dave, as the Dark Lord for Halloween. And this is not because, Cheney sees himself as evil or power hungry for its own sake. He truly believes that ruthless action has been vital to our survival. And on his way out the door, he defended the frankly infamous and long since withdrawn torture opinions by John Yoo at the Office of Legal Counsel. He called them sound. He redoubled his defense of a doctrine of executive supremacy, saying that Congress can, quote, write statutes, but, quote, can't override the president's constitutional authorities and responsibilities, meaning that the president does not have to abide by the statutes. And just this week, he said that protecting the government, protecting the country, is a, quote, tough, mean, dirty, nasty business. So Cheney's consequences are consequentiality, consequentialness. They didn't go away with the change of management at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. the legal policies and instruments that he put in place, Guantanamo, domestic surveillance, enhanced interrogation, the removal of terror suspects from the jurisdiction both of domestic and of international law, have not been excised, not yet, by the new administration, despite the four initial executive orders of President Obama. The new team is finding it harder than expected to bring about fundamental change. I'll give you one example, and you have to pay attention to the fine details to see what's going on. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, and the President have said that, in their view, waterboarding is torture. But they have not directly renounced the Cheney view that this decision is entirely the President's to make. And they have not torn down the legal machinery that permitted cruel and coercive techniques that until recently were considered war crimes by the US government and still are considered war crimes by most of our allies. This is one very good example of Cheney's effectiveness behind the scenes. I'll just quickly reprise the history on this. You had Cheney spent the first couple of years after 9/11 deleting Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, which prohibits cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment from US law. The Hamdan decision by the Supreme Court said that the President can't do that, that in fact it is enacted into US law in the War Crimes Act. And so the President, at Cheney's urging, proposed a new law, the Military Commissions Act, and then there was the Detainee Treatment Act, which Cheney didn't like, which purported to limit interrogations purported to impose the ban or reimpose the ban on cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. But the fine print, for which Cheney and his lawyer were substantially responsible, said a couple of things. It said, first of all, the President will be the one who interprets the term cruel, inhumane, and degrading. It said that the standard shall be the US constitutional standard of cruel and unusual punishment. And that cruel and unusual punishment test in US jurisprudence is that the treatment shocks the conscience. And when the Supreme Court has interpreted shocks the conscience, it's weighed all the circumstances involved. And so immediately, Cheney and his lawyer said that in light of all the circumstances, i.e. the risk of a catastrophic terrorist attack, waterboarding would not shock anyone's conscience, or certainly shouldn't. And so they'd come full circle and stated that exactly the most controversial techniques were, again, legal. And finally, Addington, Cheney's lawyer, wrote an executive order which stated that the President shall be the sole judge for all purposes in US law of whether the President's interpretation of law is lawful. Which is a good, nice work if you can get it. Barack Obama inherits a whole bunch of fights in court and in Congress that he might not have picked himself, but that does not mean he will always want to surrender when it comes to presidential power. This coming Monday, for example, briefs are due in a civil case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out in California, in which a number of detainees who were rendered and tortured in other countries are attempting to collect civil damages. The Bush administration claimed that the court can't hear the case at all because of the state secrets privilege. Obama would not likely interpret the privilege as broadly, but no president wants to open the door to a full examination of the intelligence apparatus and methods, and he's got a dilemma. He might have tried to finesse it had it not already reached this stage of appeal, but he has to worry about what precedent will be set. The fact is that any leader, anyone ambitious enough to be president, wants to be consequential. And Barack Obama has the potential, because of a number of circumstances, and we could talk about that in Q&A, to be among the most powerful presidents in our history. Cheney's legacy remains for Obama to sort out, and the new team knows it. Engler, I'm told, was pretty widely read on the transition team, both as a how-to and a how-not-to manual. Joe Biden read it, and one of his top advisors told me he read it twice, the second time taking notes. I'd actually rather he'd bought a second copy. You can't have too many, by the way. My friend Eugene Robinson, who's a columnist for the Washington Post and a frequent commentator on MSNBC, once wrote that students of public policy should be required to take a course called Cheney. What I thought I'd do today is give you the syllabus. You might call them the Cheney rules about acquisition and exercise of power, and he was an especially good practitioner of these, but he certainly didn't invent them. I'm going to read a few passages from the book that illustrate some of those rules. There's more than I can cover in the time we have, but maybe I'll throw a few more into the question period. So rule number one is fly under the radar. The first chapter of the book tells the story of Cheney's selection as Bush's running mate in 2000. And he devised the most intrusive vetting system ever imposed on potential candidates. When his own name came up, Cheney did not fill out the questionnaire. So here's a passage that starts with an interview I did with Dan Quayle. He went down through everybody's negatives, Quayle recalled, and everybody has negatives, and nobody really vetted him on what his negatives were. I also asked Cheney's old friend Dave Gribben, who was vetting the other candidates, if he looked over Cheney's records too. He replied, no. Heaven and good grief, no. No one had access to Cheney's tax and corporate records, and no one but his own doctor read a word of his medical files. Cheney did not submit even his public speeches, interviews, testimony, and voting record. Dan Bartlett, Bush's top communication strategist, said he went to Bush and told him, we're getting our asses kicked in the media because we're not prepared. Cheney wrote it out, and Bush went along. Quote, to his standard, Bartlett said, he probably thinks he's an open book. To his standard, trust me. Rule number two, see rule number one, fly under the radar. Later in the same chapter, we find out that embarrassing information from the vetting file of one of Cheney's rivals, Governor Frank Keating of Oklahoma, has been leaked to Newsweek. The version Newsweek gets is that Keating has a skeleton in his closet. He'd accepted big financial gifts without declaring them. Picking up from the book, in fact, Keating had reported the gifts and cleared them with federal ethics officers, but the gifts had not become public knowledge in Oklahoma. The Newsweek story touched off an explosion in Keating's home state. The legislature launched an investigation. Scores of local stories spoke of Keating's abandonment, even by his great friend, George W. Bush. By the time reporters examined the federal ethics rulings, the biggest man in Oklahoma was political roadkill, crushed under wheels he never heard coming. No one caught a clear view of the driver. Rule number three, which is related again to rule number one, don't mess with Cheney. It obviously came from Dick Cheney or one of his people, Keating told me. I mean, Dick Cheney coming into my life has been like a black cloud. The story did not go unnoticed in Washington. Keating made no public accusation, but he hinted at his suspicion among friends. The rumor spread, and Keating thereby did the vice president a favor he did not intend. He propagated the message, educational and just deniable enough, don't cross Cheney. The town was full of important people who had handed the vice president their most personal files. John Kasich, Tom Ridge, Bill Frist, John Danforth, John Kyle, Chuck Hagel, list goes on. Dick Cheney knows more about me than my mother, father, and wife, Frist told the Washington Post. Not, he added, that he was complaining or anything. Rule number five, you can't disclose that one. Here's another rule, silence is powerful. To understand Cheney's influence, you have to know how much he spooks people without even seeming to try. Stephen J. Hadley, who landed the Deputy National Security Advisor job under Condoleezza Rice, was another of Cheney's defense dogs, an informal group of Pentagon alumni. Like a lot of Cheney's employees then and since, Hadley admired the man and found him unnerving in roughly equal measure. One day at the Pentagon, where Hadley served as an assistant secretary in the early 1990s, he emerged from Cheney's office and ran into Dave Gribben, again as Cheney's old friend. Once again, he had briefed his boss and received little more than an inscrutable nod in reply. You know, Hadley told Gribben, Cheney somehow intimidates me. He's not trying to intimidate me, but when I'm sitting there briefing him, I'm talking a little fast. My voice is a little high. And I have to say, this relationship largely remained, as did similar relationships between Cheney and other senior officials as the Bush 43 administration came to power. Rule number six, never mind silence, screaming is powerful. And this scene begins the most extended narrative in the book. It describes what happens after the Justice Department becomes convinced that the warrantless domestic surveillance program, in part, is illegal. One day, a couple of lawyers from the NSA come calling to see what it is that Justice is worried about. A burst of ferocity stunned the room into silence. No other word for it. The vice president's attorney was shouting, "You are not going to see the opinions. The president doesn't want this. You are out of your lane." Five government lawyers had gathered around a small conference table in the Justice Department Command Center. Four were expected. David Addington got wind of the meeting and invited himself. It was going to be a very short meeting. "This is none of your business," Addington exploded. "This is the president's program." If Brenner and Potenza, that's the two NSA lawyers, had replied with the auditor equivalent of, "You're not the boss of me," they would have been right. The two men could have pressed on with their document request and told the big, loud man from the White House to get out of their way. But that kind of thing did not happen often to an emissary of the vice president, Addington least of all. The NSA lawyers returned to their car empty-handed. Rule seven, when the vice president calls, please pick up the phone. Very early one morning, a voicemail indicator began to blink in room 6140 of the Interior Department. Sue Ellen Wooldridge played the message when she arrived. "This is Dick Cheney. I understand you're the person handling this Klamath situation, and I have some questions. Please call me at..." Long pause. "I guess I don't know my own number. I'm over at the White House." Yeah, right. Who would fall for that? Wooldridge was the 19th ranking official in a department that did not exactly bask in White House attention. I thought to myself, someone is messing with me. That's not actually what she said. Wooldridge said, she pressed star D on the keypad, delete. Late that afternoon, Wooldridge returned from a meeting with and found another message, a guy named Ron Christie from the White House, Cheney's deputy domestic policy advisor. "Any special reason," he asked, "why you're not returning the vice president's call?" Oh God, not a prank. Really sorry. Rule eight, know what you want. This is gonna sound really obvious, but it's quite powerful. Let's say you're here with some friends and you have to pick a place to eat when you leave. It's not a great decision of state, just, you know, pizza or Chinese. Half of you are gonna be on the fence. Picking up from the book, David Froom, one of Bush's speechwriters, said there was a kind of aimless quality within the first year to the president's domestic policy agenda. There was nothing aimless then or ever about Cheney. There would be many reasons for Cheney's dominance in the Bush administration, some of them subtle. One was as simple as could be. The vice president knew what he wanted. Unlike most of his rivals, and even the president he served, Cheney seldom indulged in ambivalence. Either he had a direction in mind, or he regarded the choice as unimportant and stepped aside. Skip ahead here. This goes with the rule that says don't mess with the vice president. The rule is, if you're angry at Cheney, kick someone else. The second or third time that Cheney blindsided Rice and Powell, the two of them decided to send a message. They synchronized an appearance to lodge a complaint with Alberto Gonzalez. Powell at her side, Rice blazed with anger. "There will be no more secret opinions on national and international security law," she commanded. If it happened again, she would go straight to the president. Powell remarked admiringly as they emerged that Rice dressed down Gonzalez in full nurse ratchet mode. He had just compared the national security advisor to the head nurse in the 1975 film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which happened to be set, a colleague pointed out, in a mental hospital. No one believed poor Fredo was in charge of the decision to exclude Rice and Powell, but neither of them raised a ruckus with the vice president or even his lawyer. When it came to Cheney, Rice's voice, like Nurse Ratched's late in the movie, was choked to a whisper. Rule 13, know thine enemy. This scene begins after Abu Ghraib when the top national security lawyer in the White House, John Bellinger, writes a very frank memo to Condi Rice with advice that he knows Cheney won't like. And then Bellinger found out something that in 3 years as a top advisor to Rice, he had never known. Every time he wrote a memo to his boss, a blind copy was routed to the vice president's office. Scooter Libby, according to one official, made the arrangement with Steve Hadley. It was not advertised, and neither was it reciprocated. What happened in Cheney's office stayed in Cheney's office. Rule 15, watch the boss's diet. In this story, John Ashcroft finds out that Cheney is planning to create military commissions for terrorists. He doesn't like the idea. He came to the White House to protest. He found Cheney waiting in the Roosevelt Room, not the president. It was difficult to tell what the president knew, if anything, about the military order now heading toward his lunch table. Certainly, he approved the idea that this was going to be a new kind of war without a lot of lawyerly coddling. When details became important, somebody was supposed to tell him. Was he aware of Ashcroft's objections? Did Bush intend to keep his national security advisor and secretary of state as well out of the loop? Jack Marsh, an old friend and colleague, said that Cheney believed, quote, you get off the president's plate everything that you can. When Cheney cared about an issue, he did what he did with barbecue. When Lynn wasn't looking, he piled his own plate high. Every administration struggled with this question. The president should not be asked to decide matters below his pay grade, but he had to know enough to decide when he wanted to intervene. Ashcroft could have walked a few yards down the hall. He was not close to Bush, but the attorney general gets an appointment when he asks for one. How many times did a cabinet officer want to dip into that well? Ashcroft turned left at the door from the Roosevelt Room, away from the Oval Office, back out onto the street. Rule 16, if you're going to fight the vice president, go for broke. James Comey, the deputy attorney general, and Jack Goldsmith, who ran the Office of Legal Counsel, told Cheney this would be March of 2004, that they could not certify the domestic surveillance program as lawful. He calls a meeting to change their minds. The staging had been arranged for maximum impact. Cheney sat at the head of Andy Card's rectangular table, pivoting left to face the acting attorney general. The two men were close enough to touch. This program, Cheney said, was vital. Turning it off would leave us blind. How can you possibly be reversing course on something of this importance after all this time, Cheney asked. Comey held his ground. I will accept, for purposes of discussion, that it is as valuable as you say it is, Comey said. That only makes this more painful. If I can't find a lawful basis for something, you're telling me you really, really need to do it? Doesn't help me. Others see it differently, Cheney said. There was only one of those, really. John Yoo at the Justice Department had been out of the picture for nearly a year. It was all Addington. The analysis, Comey said, is flawed. In fact, facially flawed. That's lawyer speak for on its face. No lawyer reading that could reasonably rely on it. Gonzalez said nothing. Addington stood by the window over Cheney's shoulder. He'd heard a bellyful. Well, I'm a lawyer, and I did, Addington said. No good lawyer, Comey said. Rule 20. And this is almost what Tom Hanks said in that movie, A League of Their Own. The rule is, there's no crying in the Situation Room. This story begins when Bush issues an order. There will be trials at Guantanamo, and they'll start by the end of January. Cheney and Rumsfeld don't like the idea, and here's how they frustrate Rice in her effort to carry out that order. Rumsfeld finally said yes to a meeting on January 29th, 2 days before Bush's deadline. At the appointed hour, Rice took the head of the long mahogany table in the Situation Room. Cheney usually took the seat to her right, but Rice did not see him today. On that side of the table sat Andy Card, John Ashcroft, George Tenet. To Rice's left were Colin Powell and Air Force General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Between them, looking sheepish in Rumsfeld's seat, was his deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Where's the secretary, Rice asked. He's unavailable, Wolfowitz said. Rice picked up her papers. We're not going to have this meeting. We're going to reschedule this for a date in the next week, and the principals will be present. It took 2 weeks. Same room, same cast. Same question, same answer. Rumsfeld was unavailable. Rice marched out and sent a memo. There would be a meeting on February 25th, 2004. They were running a full month now behind Bush's deadline. The day arrived. The group filed in. Hadley, Card, Ashcroft, Powell, Tenet, Myers, Wolfowitz. Where's the secretary? Rice demanded. Wolfowitz looked as though he'd rather be in that other place, or anywhere. Unavailable, Wolfowitz said. Tenet stood up, pushing back his chair a little harder than strictly necessary. There are several doors to the Situation Room, and one was just behind him. This is bullshit, he said. I'm out of here. George, do not leave this room, Rice commanded. This is bullshit, Tenet pronounced, more emphatic. He took a couple of steps, and he was gone. Something happened to Rice's face, control melting away. Her eyes welled up, and the next words caught in her throat. The men in the room did not know where to look. She started to cry, said one of them, and she said, I can't remember the exact words because I was so shaken. Something like, we will talk about this again, and she turned and walked quickly out the door. I see that I'm out of time. I'd like to leave lots for question and answer, so I will just close with the thought that the very same questions raised in this book about Guantanamo, about surveillance, about the rendition of prisoners, about the prosecution of the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan are squarely on another president's desk, and I suspect that the answers, the decisions, will be a lot more complex than many of Obama's supporters desire and expect. Thank you.
Let me ask those who have questions, civil or otherwise, to queue up in the back of the room, and we will take as many as we have time for. I know Bart is anxious to take as many questions as he can, so I encourage people to come on back and let's toss hard questions at him. Let me prime the question pump for Mr. Gelman by asking, how do you get people to talk? You've got so many great stories that other top flight reporters have missed. How do you get people to tell you the things that they tell you?
The CIA talks about how it can't discuss its sources and methods, and I like to say that I can be about 50% more forthcoming than CIA. I can't discuss sources, but I can discuss methods. The method is, for one, I have the luxury of time. I took over a year to report a series in the Washington Post and then another year to do the book. And that means I can go back over and over again to people. I can make lists of people who might know something. I tend to collect directories, so I know the present and former occupants of a certain office. I divide secrets, if I have a target secret, into sort of sub-secrets and sub-sub-secrets, and then eventually they bump up against things that are public knowledge or publicly gettable. Simple example. Back in the Clinton administration, I thought that the president was about to order the commitment of U.S. forces in the Balkans, and no one was going to tell me that, but you could find out whether leaves had been canceled at Fort Bragg or whether there were an unusual number of flights from some of the usual tactical air bases and so on, whether they had stood up what they call a crisis action team at the 18th Airborne Corps. And once having known that, and I could call someone and tell them I knew that, and tell them I knew that I supposed that they were about to deploy, and sometimes people who won't talk to me who usually talk to me, suddenly won't. And the silence has become meaningful. And the more I know, the more I can get. They used to say, till recently, that you have to have money to borrow money. That's still true in journalism. The more you learn in this sort of iterative process, the more you can get. And I usually find that my success accelerates over time, so that in this book, some of the hardest targets, some of the more interesting disclosures, many of them, I would say almost half of them, came in the last 10% of my reporting time. And I often found out things I didn't expect to find out just by serendipity. I would be aiming for one thing and it wasn't there, or I couldn't get it, but suddenly I noticed this thing over here. Just one last thing on that subject. People in Washington these days are accustomed to talking anonymously. And most of my interviews began that way, but I worked very, very hard, mostly by shaming people and sometimes by saying, well, everybody else is doing it, to get people to go on the record, at least with part of what they said. And so in the end, I have Hadley and Rice and Andy Card and Josh Bolton and Ashcroft and Comey and Rove and lots of other people on the record when they didn't start off that way.
How did you put together the pieces to conclude that Cheney was really the only person seriously considered for the vice presidency?
Here, this was unexpected. Chapter two of the book was going to be chapter one. It was essentially the terms then of Cheney's early negotiation with Bush about what his vice presidency would look like and the way he set it up from the early days. But I thought, well, I ought to have a little something about how he became running mate. It's one of those cases where I really didn't expect to find anything interesting. But I dutifully called a bunch of the people who'd been named as finalists for the job. And Frank Keating, the Oklahoma governor, apparently had been waiting by the phone for 8 years to tell this story. And he gave me about 1 minute of warm-up in which he talked about his very correct and friendly background with Cheney. Cheney raised money for him and this and that. And then he said, I had no idea it would turn into a very unpleasant experience. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I felt very unprepared for it, and I just did the little reporter's trick of trying to keep my voice very neutral, and I just said, tell me. So I didn't have an intelligent question to ask. Chronology became very important. After talking to Keating, Engler, and Pataki, and a whole list of other governors and senators who were supposed to be finalists and were described as such at the time, I found out by looking at the exact chronology that none of them were interviewed before Bush chose Cheney secretly on July 3rd. There were a few who met with Cheney, and these were described as interviews at the time. But John Engler, I asked him, so tell me about your interview with Bush. He said, interview? I said, well, you know, you were here on this date campaigning in Michigan. They said you'd been, you know, interviewed for the job. And he said, well, you know, between events, Bush was mostly on a treadmill, and we chatted about our families. You know, he has twins, I have triplets, what are the chances of winning Michigan? That's what it was. It turned out that nobody was interviewed seriously for the job until after the choice was already made. They were Potemkin interviews. So chronology told the story here. And likewise, I put together in small pieces things like, I mean, I called just to see what would happen, not expecting anything much. The doctor, a guy named Denton Cooley, who was trotted out to vouch for the health of Cheney's heart during the campaign, and he said he'd not actually met Cheney or reviewed his medical files. He'd talked to Cheney's own personal doctor, who'd assured him that Cheney was healthy.
I thank you very much on behalf of everyone here for your very invaluable contributions. My question is, as you may know, a few days ago, Cheney made some rather well-reported comments on Politico.com regarding the new administration. Would you care to comment on what he said and the timing of it?
Yeah, I would. The language was similar to language he's used primarily during campaigns in 2004, 2006. When he was warning quite starkly that, in that case, if Democrats came to power or if their preferred policies were put in place, the country would be terribly vulnerable, and that every single thing they did was essential. And at the time, it was dismissed as political rhetoric and sort of over the top. And I think what Cheney is demonstrating now is that he really means it. And I think people who don't like Cheney don't like to hear this usually, but you have to understand, if you want to know what happened these last 8 years, that Cheney is, in his own way, a man of principle. He deeply believes that the things he is doing are on behalf of the national interest, that it's necessary, that he sees reality more clearly than most people do, and if people get in his way, he's simply got to go around, through, or over them, because the stakes are that high. And that's what he's saying now. He sees the country slipping away from the direction he set, and he's trying to sound a warning. It's quite unusual, by the way, for a person to leave the White House and immediately start making policy pronouncements like this, and you aren't seeing George Bush doing it. The only other example I can think of right now is Andy Card, who came out and took the stand that it was wrong for Obama not to wear a jacket and tie in the Oval Office.
Well, I'm curious, you know, especially after what you just said. My sense is there's something that happened early in Cheney's life that made him actually feel so powerless that he turned into what I see as a bully.
I have 70 pages of endnotes in this book, and I try to be quite transparent about how I know the things I purport to know. And what's on the inside of his head isn't in that category. There are times when his motivation can be described based on things he says confidentially to others, but he doesn't take very many people into his confidence at all. I have no reason to believe that he was bullied. The biography of his early years, or that he felt worthless, the biography of his early years describes a guy who was popular, who had a fairly happy home, who had the head cheerleader of the school, Lynn Cheney, or Lynn, forget what her last name was then, as his girlfriend, and felt pretty successful. Now there was this dropout period from Yale, and he was twice cited for driving under the influence. So something was going on. People more often ask me whether there was some profound change in Cheney, you know, from the time of the Ford and first Bush administration to the second, and whether that's related to his health. And I explore that pretty carefully in the book. There's a plausible theory there because he's had 8 significant cardiac events in 8 years, and the disease of the arteries of the heart is often but not always accompanied by a disease of the arteries of the brain, and that can but does not always lead to things like loss of judgment or of temper. The problem with that is that I was able to find out a lot of things that should have been a lot harder to find out than that, and I found no evidence that Cheney's mental capacity or even-tempered behavior, and he's much more even-tempered than the president was, changed anyway during these years. I found a lot of evidence that he's always believed most of the things he's been standing for here. What happened was that September 11th reinforced his belief, gave him an opportunity to carry it out, and he was much more powerful in this administration than he had been before.
All of your Cheney rules, by inference, posit a mostly empty Oval Office. There's no mention of the president, or very little. What relationship or control, how much did the president know, how much did he acquiesce in all of the matters that Cheney was putting into place?
That's a vital question, and I do address it in the book, and I was remiss in not tempering my remarks here with that. George Bush really was the decider when he wanted to be, and when he knew that the decision was on the table. And that was most of the time. Cheney's power came sometimes at the explicit direction of the president, sometimes with the president's tacit consent, and in a couple of very important cases, one of them being domestic surveillance, one of them being the 2003 capital gains tax cut, I'm able to demonstrate to my satisfaction with evidence that Cheney did things behind George Bush's back that Bush didn't know about. I think he was able to convince himself that he was serving the president's ultimate purposes. But Bush tends to be a big concept vision guy, and Cheney has lived all his life at the pivot points of government where sort of ends and means collide, and he knows that a lot of very important decisions are made in the implementation. And so I spend 3 chapters describing those 2 events to show you that there were times when Bush didn't know what was going on. Now, by temperament, Bush is not a detail man. And so as a small example, in the first months of the administration, when they quickly had to put together a federal budget, and this is the government's way of putting its money where its mouth is, huge policy implications, Bush didn't get very much into the details. And traditionally, when cabinet officers come back to the Office of Management and Budget in the White House and say, I can't live with the allowance you just gave me, they appeal to Dad in the Oval Office. And every other administration, you know, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, Carter, that appeal would be made to the president. The buck stops there. In this administration, they created a budget review board chaired by Cheney, and not one appeal went from that to the Oval Office. So Cheney got a lot of his power because Bush didn't want it.
Beyond the health theory you just proposed, what did his role as Ford's chief of staff reveal about the Cheney that you reveal in the book and about who we know now?
I was given permission by James Baker to go through his papers that are not yet open in general to the public at the Mudd Library in Princeton. And I found just a fascinating document. It was the four pages of handwritten notes that Baker took when he interviewed Cheney about what it's like to be chief of staff. Cheney obviously had been for Gerald Ford. Baker was about to come in 1980 as Ronald Reagan's chief of staff. Wrote down four pages of Cheney's advice. And I actually have some of it here. The crucial point, the only one that Baker wrote down in all capital letters, was to be an honest broker. That you should not try to control the decision by controlling the information and advice that goes to the president. You shouldn't circumvent the process, that by doing so, you harm the president. Cheney simply disregarded, did a 100% flip-flop on that as vice president, partly because his role had changed. The chief of staff does have a different role than the vice president. He also saw himself as an independently elected constitutional officer. He's the only person in the administration who does not serve at the pleasure of the president. Actually, can't be fired. And he thought the stakes were so high and the issue so important that he could not wait for what he derisively called interagency treaties, which tended to bring about the least common denominator and inhibited quick, decisive, effective action. Now, that is not a view that's unique to Cheney. He took it, as he did so many other things, beyond the usual bounds. But the core idea that sometimes you have to cut through the thicket of red tape is something that any government would recognize.
You spoke at the beginning about the difficulty the Obama administration will have in deconstructing the machinery that has been erected or constructed by the Bush administration, particularly by Cheney himself. I'm wondering if you think there is any likelihood that Cheney will be prosecuted for any of the things that he did as vice president, specifically involving the outing of Valerie Plame. Louis Libby was, of course, prosecuted and convicted, but finally pardoned for his role in outing Valerie Plame, all as a consequence of Wilson's op-ed piece demolishing the argument that the Iraqis were importing yellowcake uranium from Niger. But Wilson, as I understand it, I mean, for quite a long while, has been intending with his wife to sue Cheney for his involvement in that case. Do you think there's any likelihood that such a suit would prevail or that any other comparable suit or attempt to prosecute Cheney would prevail?
I've got a number of thoughts on that. Number one, I'm really happy that I'm not paid for my predictions. And that I'm in an empirical business. And in fact, if you could ever catch me predicting something and can quantify it, I advise you to sell it short. That said, I predict no, that he will not be prosecuted for that and can't be prosecuted for that. Louis Libby was not charged or convicted with the leak itself, as you'll recall. And it's highly unlikely that a prosecutor could meet the threshold for prosecution in the Identities Protection Act, which requires specific knowledge of various kinds, not only that the person might be or has been a clandestine officer, but that has been within a certain period of time and is going to be again, and specific intent to, I mean, there are a number of essentially mens rea tests that Fitzgerald didn't think he could meet, so he charged Libby with lying, perjury and obstruction of justice, and he got the convictions there. And one small correction, Libby, of course, was given clemency for part of the penalty, but he was not pardoned, and in fact, that's quite meaningful. I think that, I mean, the book describes a trajectory of the Cheney vice presidency in which Bush gradually lost some confidence in him, and Cheney lost some influence, though not all of it, in the second term. And if there's one thing that Cheney could ask as a personal boon to the president on the last day in office, it would be Libby. It would be a full pardon for his very close friend, Libby, who he firmly believes is an honorable man who did the right thing. And Bush said no. And Cheney admitted as much. He said in public that he disagrees with the president on that, and he said it very seldom. As far as whether Cheney could be prosecuted for the same thing as Libby was, perjury, that depends on what he told the FBI. He was interviewed by the FBI and, I believe, by Fitzgerald. Transcripts exist of that, and they have not been made public. Libby, it's quite clear, was lying in order to protect Cheney, but it depends whether, we don't know whether he was trying to protect Cheney politically, from political damage, with sort of catastrophic results because he was caught, or whether, in fact, Cheney has some potential exposure to criminal culpability. Libby was asked, and the transcripts are made public, in the grand jury, whether Cheney was the one who directed him to tell Judy Miller the name of Wilson's wife and her profession. And Libby said, it's possible, but I don't recall. So if Cheney directed that, you still have the problem of proving the other elements of the crime, and I think they can't be proved, but we don't know what the answer is, and we don't know what Cheney said.
An unrelated two-parter. The future of long perspective investigative reporting that you do so well, where would your progeny, how will that, what would that endeavor look like down the pike 5-10 years? And two, was there any evidence that the need for a wheelchair at inauguration was exaggerated, and maybe this was a nice gambit not to have to make nice with all the right people?
If I were writing a last chapter for the paperback edition, I would be tempted to call it The Wheelchair and the Shoe. It's kind of an ignominious departure on all sides. Investigative reporting. The state of the news business economically is quite dire and frightening and unknown, and I don't have any answers. And it's clear that the economic model that supported the growth of deep and substantial reporting, not only investigative reporting, but just basics, covering your state legislature where a lot of important things happen, or looking behind decisions in the city council, examining the federal bureaucracy, examining corporate behavior. The old economic model doesn't work anymore. It depended on two markets. One was reader interest in the product, but more importantly was advertiser interest in gaining access to readers' eyeballs. And in the new media environment, advertisers much more cheaply can get access to those eyeballs, and they're indifferent to what the content is. And so you have, let's say, a large fraction of the Washington Post's online readership is enjoyed by the Huffington Post, which has 35 employees. And can't, I mean, as against, you know, on the order of 700 or 800 newsroom employees at the Washington Post, and a quite small budget. The New York Times newsroom budget is on the order of $200 million a year. There is nothing out there that we can see that is going to support that kind of money, and someone's got to invent a new model, or there's a real risk that the content will be gone. That said, there is still much better journalism, much more substantial journalism on a larger scale in the investigative world being committed today than there was in the story days of Watergate. And Ben Bradley and Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein would say the same. We still have quite a few investigative resources at the Washington Post and a couple of other large news organizations, just a couple. And there is now being invented, there is one new model coming into play. It's something called ProPublica. It's a 501c3 charitable organization, a nonprofit that has more investigative reporters than the New York Times or the Washington Post, serious prize-winning people who are led by Paul Steiger, who used to run the Wall Street Journal, and funded but as yet not endowed by rich donors. And they are doing very serious, important journalism, and they are offering it free on a one-time exclusive basis to news organizations. So those stories have appeared on 60 Minutes and the New York Times and the Washington Post and elsewhere. And that is a promising supplement, but it can't substitute for a profitable commercial enterprise.
It seems that America in the past has not had such problems selecting a vice president as we appear to have had this time. Perhaps a synergy of a flawed president, new president, and a man in Cheney who had already spent too much time in government in positions of power. Having thought about the vice presidency considerably, do you have some suggestions or thoughts about what makes the ideal vice presidential candidate and what is the optimal way to make that selection?
If there's anything I'm glad I don't do more than predictions, it's prescriptions. I really am not the guy you want to hear from about what we ought to do. I try to be someone who tells you what's happening that people in power don't want you to know and what it means, what's really going on here. I don't have any special qualifications to say how it ought to go. In the case of the vice presidency, it is uniquely a creature of what the president wants. Every president will have different criteria. No vice president could have achieved Cheney's power without at least the tacit consent and the particular interaction he had with his president, although Cheney brought other considerable gifts and circumstances to bear. I mean, just one thing I haven't mentioned about Cheney is, if you want to say in a nutshell what's special about him, what's particularly potent about him, he is, on the one hand, a zealot. He is a deep believer in his principles. Those principles are edge of the envelope and sometimes beyond the edge of the envelope in relation to the previous political governmental debate. He has a drive, a will to power, and he has as much experience and operational talent as anybody alive today. You have a few other operatives on that very high level, but most of them are pragmatists. Usually, if you're very good at those kind of skills, you tend to be a compromiser and a realist and let's get something done. If you combine zealotry with operational skill, you have someone who's going to move the ball.
Lamaya, I have two questions. The first is, how much influence did George H.W. Bush have in the selection or influencing the selection of Cheney as the vice president? And the second question is, looking to the future, could we assume that we are going to have a sequel to The Angler on the role that Joe Biden is going to play in the coming 4 years?
Now, don't put me in a niche here. You know, I might want to turn my attention to something other than the number two. Role of H.W. Bush. First of all, I have to say right away that I have very little data on this, and I think nobody has very much data on this. The most interesting speculation I've seen has to do with all the interesting books and articles about the complicated father-son relationship, in which it is said that 43 really wanted 41's approval and yet felt very competitive and resentful of him and determined to cure what he thought were the flaws of his father's presidency. And so Jake Weisberg has written a very interesting book in which he speculates that Cheney couldn't have got the job had it been Bush Sr.'s idea, but that it probably helped quite a bit that Bush Sr. approved. And I think the first President Bush would have had good reason to think that Cheney would be an effective, loyal soldier, and a pragmatist, and a moderate, more or less, certainly someone who would go along with moderate principles, because that's what he always did in the past. Cheney really did serve the presidents that he worked for, and in this case, he worked for a much more radical president, or a president who was capable of being persuaded to take quite radical stances. And so what you find out if you look back at the first Bush administration, in which I covered Cheney as defense secretary, we had no idea at the time how extreme his views were, because he usually got crushed in those interagency debates by Baker and Scowcroft and the president himself. And he said right after the invasion of Kuwait, let's start sinking Iraqi tankers. And Baker said, you know, I'm this close to getting a resolution in the Security Council that will give us authority and cover and allies in repelling this invasion. And Cheney said, you know, you and Schmuin, and Bush said, no, we're going to wait. And that happened over and over again in past administrations. In this one, Cheney prevailed much more often, though certainly not always. I'll give you one quick example. Smallpox. It's eradicated in nature. It's officially, the samples exist only in two laboratories, one in Atlanta and one in, I forget which provincial town in Russia. There was intelligence that came up that said Al-Qaeda was interested in acquiring smallpox as a weapon. There was very dicey intelligence that suggested the possibility there were samples of it out of the two containment facilities. And Cheney came to the conclusion that Bush ought to order the inoculation of every American against smallpox. After this had halted decades ago, and public health people came to the president and said, if you do that, you're going to kill 200 or 300 Americans with side effects. Cheney said, you know, that's really bad, but how would you feel if 10,000 die in a terrorist attack? And he said, go right ahead and do it. And Dan Bartlett was in the room, told me that he was sitting there, you know, trying to picture, what's the public relations plan for this? But Bush got off the bus. He said, I understand your motivations. I understand you're making a serious point, but I'm not going there.
This is very edifying and frightening in some ways. And I was quickly looking at the book review, and it pointed out, and I wanted you to speak to that, that younger disciples of Cheney's will probably be around and credentialed should there be a fresh Republican administration, and the vice president may be gone, but his translucent spirit may remain. And I wondered if you could make that more lucent for us.
Translucent is seldom the word that you use to describe Cheney, one of the most opaque figures we've had in high office. There are people who believe what he believes. Scooter Libby would have been a very strong candidate for a high cabinet post in the next Republican administration had things gone otherwise. I think that many of those people have been tainted and repudiated now by the American public in a way that will probably last a while, though not necessarily forever. As I said, there are very few people in recent political history who combine Cheney's beliefs, his operational skill, and his deep knowledge of the mechanisms of government. I mean, this is a guy who not only sort of does the homework, but reads the teacher's edition and then goes out in the footnotes and reads all the works cited there. He's a deep, voracious consumer of information, and he uses it well. So you don't have many people who have his beliefs and his talent and the leash from the guy at the top to do what he did. And so I don't expect it to be a legacy as simple and clear as the one that's being described there.
Barton Gellman, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.